This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Deep in the imagination, there's a crossroads, a space where curiosity and inspiration intersect and give birth to ideas. A space where music, science fiction, comic books, and pop culture inform the mind of what is and what could be. This is Jeff Boucher's Mind Space. In each episode, legendary journalist Jeff Boucher welcomes the biggest names in genre entertainment for an expansive dive into all things pop culture. Journey with Jeff as he explores the latest news and recommendations of the hottest releases across entertainment with his most trusted confidants. You are now entering deep space. Heavy Metal presents Jeff Boucher's Mind Space.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Mind Space. This is Jeff Boucher, and I'm here with Maya St. Clair. And this week, an old friend on the show, Michael Uslan. Welcome to the show, Michael. Michael is so many things. He was one of I've been reading him since 1977, I think, maybe, when I got a hold of some comic books that he wrote for DC. And he did a trivia book back then that I loved, the Bam Pow Zap something, a trivia book, which is better than I made it sound. And but more recently, he's been, well, an executive producer on just about every movie that, well, every movie that involves Gotham that doesn't have shark repellent. He was an executive producer on, I believe. Is that right? Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think you nailed that, Jeff. Thanks. Great to be here. I love talking to you, and it's been too long.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And you, as usual, you've been just sitting around doing nothing. You have the biggest movie in the world in theaters right now, and a new book, Batman's Batman, which is a follow-up, sort of a companion piece to The Boy Who Loved Batman, your memoir. And then you also, of all things, have a Broadway show that you're working on. What do you, are you a song and dance man? Did I miss this?
Yeah, you didn't know that about me. Yeah, I was James Cagney's understudy in Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Nice.
I couldn't be more excited. At this stage of my career, 45 years in, to be pushed out of my comfort zone and be in an area where I wrote the play during COVID. And it's not like writing a screenplay or a graphic novel or a comic book or an animated episode. And it's been fascinating, absolutely fascinating to me. I am learning something new every single day. And I'm working with the greatest group of people, highlight of my career, the Niederlander Organization of New York City.
Sure, fantastic.
Couldn't ask for better people. They own like half the theaters on Broadway. Yeah. And they knew that there was going to be a new normal in Broadway post-COVID. Wow. And they were looking for entertaining properties to be made into Broadway shows that could have a sense of intimacy to them. And thematically, while entertaining, could be uplifting, filled with hope, talk about the need to dream big and the perseverance that that takes. And they felt my book just really checked all the boxes.
Wow.
For the kind of story that they want to tell on Broadway.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I have so many questions, but it's such early days on that. It's probably too soon to talk about it, but it sounds very exciting.
It is very exciting. We are in on a fast track. We'll probably have some big announcements coming over the next month or two. We'll announce some of the people attached to it. It's a creative wellspring. And again, I just feel like I'm in the best, most experienced hands in the business.
That's terrific. Well, when that one's a huge success, then I would love to sit down and talk to you about, I have all these really wonderful ideas for musicals based on the DC universe. And I'm only being half serious. I actually made up a list of what DC characters would make good musicals, because I think it'd be great to dig into the DC universe and put some musicals on. We haven't really seen one for a DC character since Superman in the 70s with, or 60s actually, with 60. Bob Holliday.
Yeah.
I think in the lead. It's Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, right?
That's exactly right. Jack Cassidy was in the show originally. Uh-huh. And Linda Lavin.
Yeah, Linda Lavin. And they had a set that was like panels of a comic book. It was like three stories tall, and you would see people in the different frames up and down the structure, which is really
yeah, it was all meant to coincide with the Batmania of the Batman television show at that stage of time in our lives.
That's right, because it was like 1969 or thereabouts.
Yeah, that sounds about right, maybe yeah. earlier. And everybody forgets off-Broadway, there was the Mad Show. There was an extension even beyond what we normally think about.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. Did you see that show by any chance?
The Superman show?
Yeah.
I didn't see it in its original run. I saw it in a later run.
Yeah. And it was, I have not seen it. And but I've heard the music, you know, very broad kind of and two-dimensional kind of portrayal kind of thing.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly my cup of tea. I was glad to see it happening. I thought Bob Holliday looked great. Mm-hmm. I understand the effects were kind of Mary Martin, Peter Pan-ish in terms of what they did. But you got to remember, you know, my story back in the 60s, I'm a blue collar kid. My parents couldn't afford to take me to Broadway shows.
Right.
They took me to my first one when I was 10, which was Golden Boy with Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh, wow.
But we didn't have that kind of money to sling around. So a lot of things I had to just dream about.
Yeah, I get that. You know, your life, your personal life and your professional odyssey is a big part of Batman's Batman, which is the new book that we mentioned. You know, I was looking at it, every chapter begins with the letter P. I thought that was great. I was looking for one that said press because I figured I would be in it just because of just longevity.
Well, wait a minute. There's one called promotion and publicity. I could have made it promotion, publicity, and press. That would have worked really well.
I think maybe put the press first, at least just for appearances, at least. When you were putting the book together, did you find that you had a lot of things that you decided you ought not to include? Did you have to filter out a lot of things just because of, you know, just people's feelings or sensitivities over the years? Did you kind of put it all in there?
No, I had to. I was raised by a mom who always taught me, if you have nothing nice to say about someone, say nothing.
Right.
And sure. That's a rule I try to live by. I also wrote this book during COVID while I was also writing the play. And I actually wrote a screenplay for the feature film version of The Boy Who Loved Batman. And I can tell you, we just signed the contract with my first choice of director on it, Howie Deutsch.
Oh, wow.
Who is just terrific and has done everything from Pretty in Pink to Young Sheldon on TV. Very excited about it. And that's something that will pop up after the Broadway play opens. There are some things, Jeff, where the wounds are still a little too fresh.
Sure.
And I didn't feel like discussing it, or I didn't feel like I had distanced myself enough from certain stories to be able to do that.
Right.
There's one or two stories I didn't want to, at this late stage of my career, wind up blacklisted.
Sure.
But that would be a good idea not to deal with. But, you know, I pretty much laid it down on the table. I think all my followers over the years, all these great, great fans, they kind of know which Batman movies were not exactly on my hit parade.
Sure.
And how I spent more time for a while trying to stop certain movies from being made than trying to make movies.
Wow.
But that's just part of the process.
Yeah. Well, the difference between good and great is what you don't do. So that was you being great. What about, you had to tell me about this Motown. You know, I was reading the book and I got to the section about, you know, a Motown collaboration. I remember the Marvel Casablanca Records deal in the late 70s that didn't really go very far, but was Dazzler and all that. What can you tell me and to our listeners about the Motown experiment?
Well, there's two parts to the Motown story. Let me deal with the feature film first. After I had the rights to Batman, I went to Motown and I said, listen, I've done Batman. I can't just do the Atom or, you know.
It's a long way down.
You know, a typical superhero. I need something that's really special. I said, and Stanley and company have really, they broke open the industry with their work on Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, Black Panther. And Luke Cage was the first one to actually get his own magazine title. I said, I want to acquire the rights to Luke Cage and bring it out as a feature film. Well, I got Motown really excited about the prospect. We actually signed the contract. I signed the contract with Marvel, acquiring the rights to the IP, the intellectual property. And the first person who had some great ideas about it was my old Batman alumnus, Robert Wool. And we had a great first meeting about it. And at that point in time, Universal was led by Suzanne DePass, but Motown was led by Suzanne DePass, who was terrific.
Sure.
And they had been acquired by Universal, mm-hmm. and everything was running through Universal. And truth be told, we couldn't make a lot of headway.
Yeah. What year would this have been, would you say?
Oh, man.
I'll look it up if you
talk. Yeah. The years start to blend.
Sure.
I'm going to guess it was right after Batman, which would have put us in 89.
Yeah.
That's just the best guess, but we can research that one.
That makes sense.
You know, and it was a time, Jeff, that was so different than the times we're living in right now.
Yeah.
It was a very, very tough sell to try to get any company interested in a project that centered around a protagonist who was Black.
Sure.
I mean, it was just a different era. It was like a different world back then.
Yeah, especially Luke Cage, because it would have been sort of street stories. I mean, it would be hard to do it without having like an urban, you know, kind of edge to it that people really would have made it even further from the mainstream option that they were looking for.
Definitely. It was going to be set in Times Square in the 80s, which was not the greatest place on earth at that moment in time. It was very urban. And it was about a guy, if you remember the early days of it, who, you know, his main job was to try to get on the 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock news and advance the PR for his Hero for Hire firm.
Yeah.
So it was very, very urban in terms of.
And kind of based, I mean, loosely, certainly influenced by Dolemite and the Blaxploitation movies. I mean, that went into the ingredients that Marvel added when they made Luke Cage. Right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Then the second Motown thing, you know, my partner on Batman was Ben Melnicker.
Yes.
Ben was my dad's age. Ben was a legend in the movie industry. In MGM's Tiffany days, Ben started at MGM in late 1939. Not a bad year for MGM or for movies generally.
Yeah.
And wound up becoming the sole executive vice president. All divisions reported to him. He was the chairman of the film selection committee and was on the parent board at Lowe's. And Ben said to me, I'm having lunch at the Friars Club with one of my old friends from the days of MGM Records and our music department, Clarence Avant.
Oh, wow.
And he said, Clarence is a legend in the business. I said, oh, my God, I've heard of Clarence. Yeah. He said, would you like to join us for lunch? I said, Ben, that would be awesome. So the three of us had lunch that day. And as we were talking, and I don't think there's anyone I have more respect for than Clarence Avant and everything that he's accomplished.
Yeah.
He is a titan and the nicest guy in the world.
Authenticity all day long. Authenticity all day long.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he said to me, you know, Michael, what you've done with Batman, he said, is just terrific. He said, you know, I'm on the board at Motown. And a lot of our properties have kind of been gathering dust of late. He said, if you ever have any ideas about something that can be done to kind of jumpstart the Motown library, he said, that would be great. And then on the spot, Jeff, and you know how I work and what I do, I go, well, wait a minute, I have an idea.
Yeah. I have an outline. I just did it.
And right there at that lunch, I said, what if we turn Gotham, Motown, into like a Detroit version of Gotham City? Mm-hmm. And we create Motown superheroes. And it was like, well, you know, what are you talking about? I go, well, think about it for a second. All the names of the Motown groups would make great superhero names. You've got the Supremes, three women of supreme intelligence through the supreme power, supreme beauty. You've got the Four Tops. I can picture them spinning madly, you know, with superpowers. You've got the Temptations. I said, whoa, I mean, you know, that could have all sorts of meanings. I said, and plus, I said, wait a minute. You've got a name that Marvel can't trademark because you were there first, the Marvelettes.
Oh, wow.
How amazing is that as a superhero name? I said, and if you could work the right kind of deal, you even have your own Harry Potter in Little Stevie Wonder, who could be the blind magician, young magician of the group.
Sure. Songs of Inner Vision.
And we started to talk, and I said, you could do new versions of the old songs. We could create villains out of the titles of the old songs. You know, there was that great song, Turn to Stone.
Oh, yeah.
I said, bingo, we got ourselves a villain.
That's great.
And that's how it all evolved. He was super, super, super excited about it. Unfortunately, there was not a lot of interest over at Universal back then at that time.
Yeah.
And like many other stories I tell in my book, many other projects that I was so excited about that I saw the opportunity to be a great hit and to do something different, not just cookie cutter stuff, but to try to be different, that that sank in the West. And that was it.
Yeah. Well, it's that's a fascinating one. I wonder if it could still be turned into a comic book, at least.
Okay. I'm working on it.
That's great. You know, Suzanne DePass, I actually have some history with her that predates our history. She was a producer, as you know, and she did Lady Sings the Blues, which got Diana Ross an Oscar nomination, and she produced Roots, the television event of the 1970s, and she also produced Lonesome Dove, which is one of the great miniseries ever on television. And I had some dealings with her. She optioned my book back in the 90s, the crime book that I did.
I never did about, that.
Yeah, the book I did about the gang member turned cop, the true story about a Santa Ana gang member, female gang member, and how she, turned her life around and became a police officer and went back into the same neighborhood as an undercover cop where she grew up.
Wow.
But Suzanne DePass optioned it, and they were going to make a TV movie out of it, Two Nights, and I was so excited. And you talk about things that kind of come and go. The book was, called Two Badges, and it had a lot of the duality of the gang life and the police life. And they wanted to do first night, she would be a gang member, and second night, she would be a cop. And it was all just perfectly arrayed and everything. And then, you know, she actually had some health issues for a little bit, and then that slowed things down. And then NBC decided that they wanted to do Gulliver instead. Mm-hmm. And it was all over, just like that.
That's why I say in Batman's Batman, you need a very high threshold for frustration in this business.
Yeah.
Happens all the time. And you've got to be Johnny Appleseed. You've got to be throwing things out left and right, because you never know after 5 years or 10 years what's going to wilt on the vine at the last minute and what's going to bloom and flourish.
Yeah, well, and look at, you know, for instance, comic book movies. I mean, now people just assume that, you know, because Marvel is what they are now, it's always been that way. But I mean, you and I remember a time when Marvel, I mean, they, you know, Marvel stopped traffic in comic books, but they couldn't get a cab in Hollywood. You know, like, they, you know, Howard the Duck and, you know, and Blade started turning things around. But I mean, Marvel had a really stubborn reputation as being not good enough for the big screen.
Well, the first two shots were Captain America and Fantastic Four, which were deemed unreleasable ultimately. But yeah, you know, I talked to Jim Galton, who was the president of Marvel at the time, a great, great guy. And I said, you know, I think what they were tending to do back then was whoever came in the door and put down the biggest amount of money as an option, they made the deal. And there was no real strategy to it.
Right.
It was just money talks. And it was only after they got off of that, that things really began to come together. You know, there's a great, great story I had where after Batman opened, so it opened in June. So probably it was fall. I get a call from Jim and he said, Joe Calamari, who was their head of business affairs, fabulous, wonderful guy, good friend. He said, we'd like to take you to lunch. I said, great. So they wind up taking me to lunch at like the most expensive restaurant in New York. And we're there and they're ordering this very expensive bottle of wine. And halfway through the lunch, I go, okay, fellas, what are we doing? What's going on? And Jim said to me, Michael, this is our thank you. I said, for what? He said, for your Batman movie. He said, you've brought attention back to the comic book industry. The general public did not even seem to know that comic books were still being published,
right,
because the candy stores, the little drug stores had dried up, 7-Elevens had stopped carrying comic books. He said, all of a sudden you made them aware that there are comic book shops and you can go and buy comic books. He said to me, our sales are up like 20% across the board. And this was just our thank you. I mean, it was lovely. I went back to Jim back in the early 1980s, again, trying to push the envelope. I was at the forefront of the new interactive producing.
Right.
And at that time, it was video discs, interactive video discs. And I had a deal. There were three services at the time. VHD, which was a joint venture of JVC, General Electric, and Thorn EMI, that was coming to America. There was RCA, that had the stylus to play the video games, and Pioneer, which was all laser. And I went to Jim and I said, listen, look at what we've done here. We've done our first one. And there's all this potential for branching where you could do kind of choose your own adventure in video style. It's like gaming meets this. And I got them excited about where the future was headed. We signed a contract for me to acquire all interactive / internet rights of the entire Marvel library for $5,000. And I went to RCA.
Yeah.
And as I got in the door, they said, they just announced we're throwing in the towel. We can't compete with the lasers. I said, fine. I went to VHD and they told me, we just decided we're going to abort our North American debut. So all I was left with was Pioneer. So I went to Pioneer in North Jersey and sat with them and laid the whole thing out. I go, for $5,000, the whole Marvel, every Marvel character. And they said, well, we really think that the potential for interactive video is really music concerts, where you could press a button and go right to a specific cut. And there's two soundtracks, so you could do commentary on it. I said, no, but we can do all of this superhero storytelling. Yeah. And again, I said, look, I'll put up half the money if you put up $2,500. Okay. They said, nah, it's not where we're going. Thanks, but no thanks. I had no outlets left. And that was the end.
It's like
that deal.
It's like having like a stack of Betamax tapes. You know, it's like, oh, now what?
Yeah.
That's frustrating. You know what they say? Sometimes a person who's ahead of their time is somebody that has bad timing. No, just joking.
No, no kidding. There is a price to be paid when you're always trying to be cutting edge and ahead of the pack.
Absolutely.
There's an absolute, that's why it took 10 years for Batman to get made.
Yeah.
You know, I had an opportunity to buy Marvel back in the early 90s when it went bankrupt a second time. And that story is in the book. I could have bought it for $95 million, but the people that we were talking to on the financial side didn't get it. Yeah. I had an opportunity through Stan Weston, God bless him, to buy DC Comics back around 1984 for $11 million, not to include Superman.
Wow.
It could include the comic book publishing, but all other Superman rights they would keep. But we had something like 60 days to try to raise $11 million. And we got laughed out of every office on Wall Street. They said, you want $11 million for a funny book company?
Yeah.
And Stan told me, yeah, Stan told me that when our time ran out, they offered it to Marvel. And Stan wanted to do it, but Martin Goodman talked to his lawyers and they said there's going to be huge antitrust issues.
Yeah,
it's going to get very expensive and drawn out. And that never happened. And, you know, certainly everybody over at DC Warner are very happy about that.
It's fascinating to think, you know, you mentioned how Marvel projects, it was whoever walked in the door that had an interest on a particular character. Everything was... it was like spread out on a blanket at a flea market. You know, you just pointed and make a deal. DC was wholly owned by Warner Brothers by the time Superman came out. I mean, it was owned by Warner like in the beginning.
Communications, yeah.
Yeah. But look at how it affected their approach to the DC library. Their approach was there's Superman and that's it. And then eventually, okay, there's Batman too. And then for years, it was Superman, Batman, Superman, 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 Batman, Batman, Batman. You know, like if you look at the movies, and they never really went further down into the catalog. While the Marvel ones, when they were piecemeal, at least when people got passionate about a secondary or tertiary character, it propelled it to still get a movie. But in DC, you didn't really see that happen. I mean, for years, I mean, Superman... was the first character to have multiple movies. Batman was second.
Yep.
Third one, I believe, was Swamp Thing.
Yep.
It was the third character to have more than one movie. And after that, it went...
One correction in that.
Is there
it, went, it actually went Superman, Swamp Thing, Batman.
For the second? For the,
yeah, the second one was out by 89.
89, that's right. Okay, even better, even better. And then after that, like, what is the next DC character to have a sequel that isn't already on the list? I think it was R.E.D. Well,
it wasn't Supergirl.
No, I think it was like R.E.D. Like, it's a long way after that. I mean, because like none of the films had sequels, you know? Supergirl didn't have a sequel. Green Lantern didn't have a sequel. The Losers didn't have a sequel. Constantine didn't have a sequel.
That's a shame. That should have
been. That one is a shame. I'm sorry. I knew that was going to hurt when I said it. I should have held that one back. But I think, believe it or not, after Swamp Thing, if I'm not mistaken, I think the R.E.D. Sort of the fun spy based Vertigo title was the next DC property that actually secured a sequel.
That could be exactly right. You know, Jeff, I've been a parrot over the years, and I've explained internally and to anyone else who would kind of listen that you have to look at the history of these two companies to understand cinematically how the universes work.
Mm-hmm.
So in my opinion, and now I'm going to speak as a comic book historian.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel was created by one writer. Okay. Now, that is casting no aspersion on Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko, who co-plotted, you know, everything starting in the earliest days.
Of course. It's the Marvel method.
The Marvel method. but it was one writer, one editor. Mm-hmm. And it had a unified vision from coming from that, from the fact that it was one unified universe. So across the Marvel comics, the tone was consistent. Mm-hmm. Who the audience they were speaking to was consistent. Mm-hmm. What the rules were in this universe were consistent.
Right.
Who was in New York City on any particular month was consistent.
Absolutely.
What was in outer space? What was under the sea? Consistent.
Right.
Now, you go over to DC Comics historically, and there were always 6 to 8 editors. Mm-hmm. And they ran their particular characters. They possessed them, fully possessed them. It was like a fiefdom where they would build a castle and put a moat around it with alligators, and nobody else could touch it. Mm-hmm. They hired their own writers and artists. The editors decided who their audience was. So, like, take Batman, for example. You could have Murray Boltonoff was a great editor there. He was doing Brave and Bold, Superman and Batman and World's Finest Comics, talking more to the 8 to 12-year-olds.
Sure.
And then you had Julie Schwartz, you know, trying to make Batman dark and realistic. And so it was just scattered about. The greatest example of that I always like to use was maybe around 1960 or 61. I go in to buy a comic book on a Wednesday. The new ones came out. I buy an issue of Action Comics, and I think it was a Showcase Aquaman.
Oh, I know where this is going.
Okay, so I go home and I read Superman. And in that, he meets a mermaid.
Right.
And he falls in love with a mermaid with a tail.
Lori Lemon.
And she's from Atlantis. And Atlantis is a dome city under the water that's completely populated by mermen and mermaids.
Right.
I love that as a kid. Then I pick up Aquaman. He's the freaking king of Atlantis.
There's no dome.
There are no mermaids. And these are two books from DC coming out the same week.
Yeah, something's going wrong. Obviously, Superman's been, you know, pranked by somebody. Like, I mean, there's something.
So how can you expect organically for a cinematic universe to be one unified story?
Right. And people wanted it was because that, as you say, Stan had his hand in everything, but it was also because he had to, right? I mean, he was churning out. I mean, the Marvel method was, you know, driven in large part by the fact that he didn't have time to write scripts. So, you know, let's talk about the story. You start, you send it, I'll fill in the words. I mean, it's very resourceful, but it also led to so many interesting things because it led to the connectivity that you're talking about. Like New York, you would see like Thor fly by for no reason at all in the back of a panel of a Daredevil, and it'd be so exciting for the reader. But there was also panels where things didn't really fit, and Stan would just add these, like, well, I'm your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, you know, like some just random non sequitur declaration of hipness. And it gave this kind of meta feel to the whole thing. And it's just fascinating how something that was a mechanism of production and practicality ended up having such a profound effect on the fundamental differences between these mythologies, as you said.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why I am personally a believer in a Gotham City universe, mm-hmm. a Metropolis universe, an Atlantis universe, a Paradise Island universe, because that is what DC was all about virtually since day one.
Right, right. It does make team-ups less, makes them potentially unwieldy, you know.
There was a Batman filmmaker who said to me when the idea of a Justice League came up, wait a minute. There's an interest in seeing a movie in which Batman is in a scene with a green guy from Mars looking over his shoulder, and on the other shoulder, in a 1-inch tall floating easy chair, this big, and they are talking to a guy who talks to fish.
Right.
And that question sums up a lot of challenges.
Absolutely. I think I know. I think I know who that filmmaker was. I think I've had that discussion with that filmmaker at different point in time, a long time ago. It's true. It's fascinating. There's a point in The Eternals where Superman is mentioned. There's actually he's mentioned twice, and there's a reference to Batman as well, which is sort of fascinating. So that's a Marvel movie that's mentioning DC characters as they exist in the Marvel universe. They're known, but they're merely two-dimensional pieces of entertainment. That's sort of a fascinating thing. And then Marvel's done a couple things like that. They mentioned Empire Strikes Back. You know, Spider-Man mentioned them in I think Civil War. He's like that old movie, you know, the one with the walkers, the things walking. It occurred to me that this is building on what we were just talking about that Stan did. I mean, one of Stan's things was that, you know, have the action be in New York, recognizable landmarks. If you're in Gotham and Metropolis, it just means you're not in the real world because there's no place that looks like that or that. And it changes all the time in the portrayal of it anyway. But if you're in New York, everybody knows where you're at. They recognize the stuff. So it'll feel more real. And I think this is building on that is, of course, Superman is known in the Marvel Universe because the Marvel Universe is our universe. And we see Superman comic books. So, of course, Spider-Man's going to know what Empire Strikes Back's back is, but in a way it's so it kind of demotes DC as the, you know, that's the fake stuff, but we're Marvel, we're real. I have that theory. Do you think any of that holds up to scrutiny?
Well, I think first of all, I think you're right, except I think it's fun. I think it's yeah. People who love the genre are having fun with it.
And oh yeah, none of that's bad
for fans.
Yeah, none of that. Yeah.
You know, little Easter eggs that they can sink their teeth into.
Sure.
Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work. Even in a DC movie. What was that one movie? I've blanked on the title. I think George Clooney was in it.
Batman and Robin.
Where he makes a reference to Superman.
Oh yeah, yeah.
As a comedy line.
Yeah. Something about it.
So even DC movies at one time or another tossed out in the same tone, those kind of lines. You're not going to find that in Gotham City, not in our Gotham City. And that's part of the thing, you know, Stan was right. And that was revolutionary about setting things in the real world in New York. But it's changed for the better over at DC because of Tim Burton's big idea. Mm. And when Tim Burton, that brilliant young genius, said that regarding the world building, Gotham City had to be the third most important character in the 1989 Batman movie. And literally from the opening frames, audiences had to believe in Gotham City in order to then suspend their disbelief and believe there could be a guy getting dressed up as a bat and fighting a guy who looked like the Joker. Mm-hmm. The world building that's been done on Gotham City brilliantly, geniusly, again, in The Batman, which is now out in theaters. That's been a remarkable, remarkable, elevating part of the Batman universe, cinematic universe. And I think that creating that own universe, and I don't believe Star Wars is necessarily in that particular universe. I don't think you're going to see Bruce Wayne going to a Star Wars movie,
right.
And probably not a Marvel movie. But it's just so interesting how the approaches are so utterly different, yet work in their own rights.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's all a fantastic mess, and it's fascinating to see how the gears work and how people put this modern mythology. It's amazing how far it's gotten. I mean, I think you and I met probably around 2007 or 2008, maybe. And the difference between now and then, in the way that these movies are made, the way that they're perceived, the way that they are handled, the way that they're discussed, reviewed, just light years different. I remember going to my editor and saying, there's a movie coming out called X-Men. It's going to be big. And he's like, come on. We already sell this movie. And I said, no. There's never been a movie like this. It's going to be like, I mean, this is the best-selling comic book there is the X-Men. That's the best-selling comic book. And he's like, but we saw this already. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, Mystery Men. It's the same movie. And like, he thought it was going to be Mystery Men, which is not the same as X-Men at all.
No.
Very, very different. And I had to, he's like, okay, convince me why these movies are different. And I sat there for like 20 minutes and tried to explain why the X-Men and Mystery Men were different. And he let me do the story, but he was still skeptical, you know. Yeah. The first movie set I was ever on was Spider-Man in 2000. And I think I've been on 50 movie sets. I was making a list the other day. That'd be a good book. I should put that together.
Yes, you know? It would be.
But in a way, that movie, that was, what would you say was the big turning point movies? Just maybe three. I mean, Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man?
I mean, I would say Superman, Batman, and X-Men.
X-Men.
But here's a part of the whole history of the thing that has been completely forgotten. Post-Batman 89. Mm-hmm. The most successful comic book movies that were launched
after that
were comic books that never sold more than 5,000 copies per issue.
Okay.
It was Men in Black.
Sure. Yeah.
It was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Right.
And it was The Mask.
Right.
So the whole concept that you needed a Superman or a Spider-Man in order to have a blockbuster film kind of went out the door in favor of something that was just a great story with great characters.
That's true.
And Although, that went to X-Men and to Iron Man. People forget Iron Man was a second banana Marvel superhero.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Maybe third banana, really.
And X-Men was the one group Stan said he couldn't make successful. Fantastic Four took off in the comics. Avengers took off. X-Men kind of, after Kirby left, it just kind of stayed with its nose above water for a while, then went to all reprint and then vanished. Neil Adams and Jim Steranko came in. Stan said, look, this book's a mess. It's dying anyway. Go do whatever the hell you want to do with it. And, right. You know, they each took a crack at it. But it wasn't until it came back years later that the X-Men rose to a level.
You know, do you think, two quick things. So I think maybe on that, it's because that was X-Men was the first Marvel characters really that didn't get their powers through affliction or ambition, or I mean, they were just born this way. Like, and the ones that had been born this way previous to them were like, you know, aliens or demigods, or, you know, they had different situations. But the X-Men, you know, he didn't have to come up with an origin story for them. So they didn't have the personal origin stories that everybody else had. I mean, they were oppressed and they were ostracized and persecuted, but it had a different rhythm than the other characters.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it was the first movie that shed the spandex and went into leather and something that just felt and looked more human.
And started a concentration camp, which is sort of a declaration of intent right there. I mean, that's, you know, that you have to give Bryan Singer and company a lot of credit for starting that movie like that, because I can see people getting cold feet about that. I mean, it's still surprising that they did it.
I agree.
At that point in time and everything.
That was bold.
The movies that were based on comics that sold under 5,000 copies or small press runs that you mentioned, like Men in Black and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. You know, the reason that we didn't see another you know, sort of volley of those, another flurry of them, I think, is because it's your fault because of that 1989 Batman movie. It wasn't good enough to do Men in Black. You wanted something that had a toy line built in. Like everybody, I mean, the merchandise and the marketing and the licensing that surrounded that 1989 movie. I mean, Superman 1978 changed. There had never been a superhero blockbuster before that. There had never been that big of investment on a comic book movie. I mean, that was a moment in time. It was, people forget too, it was Warner Brothers' most expensive movie they ever made up until that point. Superman was when it was released. Yeah. So, I mean, it was, you know, a massive pivot point. But the innovation of of Batman 1989 and the changes, the way that it changed the entire rhythm of the industry and the amount of plastic and amount of paper and amount of metal products that have landed on the American shelf around that summer of 1989 that had a bat on it. It's unbelievable. It was like everything in the world had a bat on it for like 3 months.
It's absolutely true. It was the magical summer. And Paul Levitz, former president of DC Comics, explained to me that there wound up being an industry-wide shortage of the black cotton material that they needed for the t-shirts, that the Batman t-shirts just ate up every bit of product that was out there to put the bat symbol on. It was that crazy. In my book, I document the call I got from the president of Kenner Toys, that they had a crisis and they needed me in Cincinnati like the next morning. I said, what's going on? He goes, well, we've got this whole new Batman license and we're going to have Batman in all different colors, because in Batman 89, we could only sell like one Batman figure, and we need to do something different, and they won't let us do it. I said, all right, I'm on my way.
Yeah.
I show up at this meeting and there's like 24 people in the room, and they showed me the prototypes, which was like a red Batman, blue, green, white, gold, silver. And I said, I love this idea. What's the problem? He said, the problem is your contract with DC Comics. It says that for any toys or merchandising, it has to appear the way Batman appears in the comics. And DC tells us, no, Batman, we let him have a black outfit for the movie. So black or the gray and blue, that's all we can accept. That's him in the comics. I said, okay. I brought with me from my collection the rainbow Batman.
Oh, nice.
The zebra Batman. The strange costumes of Batman, which had the green one when he was in the jungle, the white one when he was in the Arctic.
The composite Superman Batman.
Yeah, exactly. I said, here's all the issues. They then called DC Comics. They said, this is how he's portrayed in the comics, and that's how the toy line got made.
Nice.
But the sad part of the story, Jeff, is that sometimes movie studios, which today are conglomerates, not just movie studios, have many wheels to grease. They own many different types of companies, from theme parks to pieces of toy companies. And sometimes executives get far too caught up in toys and merchandising and Happy Meals. Yeah. And the worst thing of all is when that becomes the center point and the tail wags the dog, and they bring in filmmakers and instruct them that they need, according to the toy companies and the licensees, they need three heroes in a movie, three villains in a movie, each one with two costume changes with
two vehicles.
And my wailing was that, well, now you're making 2-hour infomercials for toys. But if you bring in filmmakers who have a love for and a vision for a character and a story and let them just make great films, you'll sell toys anyway.
That's right.
That wasn't always the outlook. And that was an extremely, deeply frustrating part of my career.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. You know, it's a good time to be enjoying superhero stuff. And the place that we've gotten... a lot of people, and I'm one of them, but I know it more than most people, a lot of people owe you a great debt of gratitude for being such a great, you know, guardian protector of Gotham and all the Golden Age guys. I mean, you introduced me to Jerry Robinson. I'll always be in your debt for that, just for a chance to meet somebody like that. And what you did for the guys, the Siegel and Schuster types, and the guys that unfortunately have left us in mass. Good on you, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah.
To me, it was always a personal responsibility. When I was 13 years old, I met Bill Finger for the first of two times, and he told me how Batman was created. I think I may be the only person left alive who ever actually met Bill Finger. Maybe one of two, actually. Otto Binder, who co-created with C.C. Beck, Black Adam, and Mary Marvel, and Captain Marvel Jr. Went over to DC and co-created Supergirl, Brainiac, the Legion of Superheroes, Crypto the Superdog. All these people were denigrated in the 1950s when comic books came under attack. Sure. They were ridiculed. Their work was, everybody looked down their nose at them. And I've always felt a personal responsibility to them, not just to the characters, to respect the integrity of the characters, but to respect their integrity. And the fact that so many of the artists who are now gone, their work is now hanging in museums, selling for $1 zillion, hanging in art galleries, being studied in schools. This was something I set out to do. And if they couldn't appreciate it, at least their children, their grandchildren, and their great grandchildren can. I always felt a personal responsibility for that.
Yeah. Well, it's a responsibility that you've handled well, and the way you've handled it has inspired people like me to try to pitch in and help out when I can. Through the years writing about stuff when it kind of comes my way, and that's something that I appreciate. So. Well, thank you for joining us, and you know, you're welcome back next week and the week after that. Anytime you want to talk, it's always good to see you. And congratulations on this little movie of yours, this little small student film that's out in theaters now.
It's incredible. I couldn't be more excited. And let's throw the spotlight onto another genius, Matt Reeves.
Oh, he's a great guy too.
And all I can say is, whether you look at the actors, the writing, the direction, the cinematography, the music, the editing, it's just masterful. It's a mastering of the crafts.
Absolutely.
And every Batman fan, every true Batman fan, is just going to love this.
That's great. And Matt's such a great guy. I got to know him down at Comic-Con, interviewing him on stage a couple of years for the Apes movies. Just what a thoughtful guy. And I love the story about him and JJ when they were kids in the Super 8. They won a Super 8 film contest, and there was a story in the LA Times, my favorite newspaper. And that story was seen by Steven Spielberg, who said to his then secretary, Kathy Kennedy, "Can you reach out to these kids and see if they'll fix up my old Super 8 films?" And so Spielberg had like four films that he had made. A war movie was one of them. One was an alien movie. As a kid. And so Kathy Kennedy drives out to the Valley and hands them to J.J. Abrams, who's like 13, 14 years old, says, "Here, fix these up, because that's what you do." You know, it's just such a strange and wonderful story. And the fact that they would all come back together, I mean, J.J. and Kathy and Steven doing like Super 8, and Matt working with J.J. on Cloverfield, and just seeing the energy of all of that. That's just really lovely.
It's amazing how things circle back. And I'll end with this. I recently went through some old correspondence and found that starting in late 89 was when I started campaigning with the studio to have a movie devoted to the side of Batman as the world's greatest detective.
Oh, yeah.
It's only taken 33 years to get it. But now I can safely and honestly say it was worth the wait.
That's great. That is great. Well, get some popcorn for me, because I want to go see it today.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you again for joining us, and come back in real soon.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.